Center for Cultural Leadership. PN Duplan.
Good morning, everyone. I wanted to mention that I'm just so delighted by all of the improvements and renovations and upgrades. And this what was a gym, now just a lovely sanctuary. I had a very small part in establishing this congregation, which to my way of thinking actually began in the old sanctuary at the old Church of the King in Corpus, where Jack Carter was pastor and a group of scruffy old men from the valley came to visit and said, we need some oversight in starting a congregation. By the way, that's the right way to do it. You don't just go out and start a church because you think it's a good idea. You have to have accountability. Those men did that. I'm going to speak today on an interesting topic. At least it is to me. I hope it is to you. The biblical gospel versus the Marxist gospel. It is extremely relevant, and I think that fact will become apparent as I talk. First, I'll summarize the biblical gospel. Sadly, many people don't know what it is. The most important news in human history is the gospel of Jesus Christ. We're bombarded 24/7 with cable and TV news and internet news sites, and even still a few newspapers, though they are rapidly vanishing. Most of this news is bad news, in which modern media specializes, but there is a good news that demolishes the bad news, and that bad news, that good news rather, is the biblical gospel. Now, the gospel in the Greek is the euangelion. Now, this word didn't begin in the Bible. It's not a theological word at all. It was used in the Greco-Roman world before Jesus Christ was ever born. It's fascinating to consider how the ancient Greeks used that word, euangelion. We say gospel. It was closely associated with the imperial cult, the Roman emperor. The emperor issued good news. That was his gospel, his gospel. He himself embodied the good news. He was considered in some sense divine. He healed. He performed miracles. He was the world savior, according to him, of course. He, as the God, protected the state. Great signs accompanied his birth and life. His words became sacred writings, alternative to this. He granted great power to humans under his care. No wonder his life and actions and words were celebrated as gospel. The emperor himself was euangelion, gospel, good news. This was ancient Rome's imperial gospel. Now, primitive Christianity was anti-imperial at its very core. That is, it was calculated to overturn the pagan Roman Empire and replace it with the gospel empire of Jesus Christ. In his death on the cross, he crushed Satan and his hosts that had led the world into sin's slavery. In his resurrection, Jesus inaugurated God's new world order, his new kingdom of righteousness designed to flood the earth. Jesus of Nazareth is now King Jesus. He subverts and condemns Caesar as the Roman emperor and any other pretenders to empire since. While Christ's kingdom is not a political kingdom, his gospel crushes the overamped devotion of man to any political emperor or empire and redirects that devotion to Jesus Christ as Savior and Lord. Jesus, not Caesar, is Lord and Emperor. This is the only genuine good news for the world. Now, this gospel is rooted in creation. God directly created the universe and everything in it for his glory. Perfect, virtuous, sinless, pristine. Adam and Eve sinned and brought corruption and judgment down on that entire created order. Everything evil, everything harmful, everything disturbing, everything corrupting that you see around you in today's world has its roots in a single act of disobedience thousands of years ago in a beautiful garden in what is today Iraq or Iran. Sin, law-breaking, man's rebellion. This is the cause of all the world's problems. But God didn't leave man and creation in sin. He promised to overturn and to reverse and defeat sin in his Son, Jesus Christ. In short, the evangel, the gospel, the good news is that God in his Son is overturning and crushing what Satan used the serpent to do in the garden. That, in a nutshell, is the gospel. The gospel of Jesus Christ is the cosmic purging and destruction of evil. It is nothing less than that. This is the storyline of the Bible. If somebody asks you, what is the Bible all about? You say, well, if I have only three words, it's this: creation, fall, redemption. It's a lot more than that, but that's a nice little three-word sequential summary. If you understand that, you'll understand at least the basic structure of the Bible. You'll also understand what God is doing in the world. Now, it's because most Christians over the last 100 years have seen the gospel as something less than this that the church is so weak and toothless. They don't really know what the gospel is in all of its fullness. But although Satan's destiny is doomed, he didn't go away after the garden or even after the cross. Since then, he's always offered his own gospel, his own perverted good news to us and for humanity. In the Western world since the 19th century, there's perhaps been no more dangerous and successful false gospel than the gospel of Marxism. I'm going to talk about that for a few minutes. And make no mistake, Marxism is a gospel. It's good news. Of course, it's actually bad news for humanity, but it's good news to the ears of rebels. To sinners lusting for their own autonomy, there's no better news than Marxism. Marxism is good news to lazy, irresponsible people. Now, all of us are born into sin, which includes laziness and envy and irresponsibility, and Marxism reinforces that sinful propensity. Marxism despises what it calls the profit motive. It abhors private property. It abominates individual economic incentive. Now, Karl Marx, you may know, was an atheist and a materialist. There's no God, no spirit, no heaven, no hell, just the physical world. Everything real is physical. Man is nothing more than blood and bone and nerves and chemicals and electrical impulses, to Marx. This means that man's only needs are material: food, shelter, clothing, sex. According to Marxism, the good society, the just society, is the society in which all people live in basically the same material situation. So Marxists attempt to create societies that claim to secure economic equality. Never mind that no Marxist society in the history of the world ever did this. Never mind that every communist country has plenty of haves and have-nots, the haves being the politicians and the bureaucrats, and the have-nots almost everybody else. Never mind that citizens aren't content with their little material pittance, but spend hours in line for basic necessities, almost like this past week in Texas, and for 5 years waiting for an automobile. If there's any equality, almost everyone is equally poor in communist societies. Now, Marxism is an unmitigated lie, holding out deceptive expectations. But it's a lie for which sinners lust, one that they want to believe, a lie that they want to believe. This is a big part of the good news of Marxism, that you could have every material thing that you need, not want, but need in life without working hard to get it and keep it. Marxism is the gospel of laziness and envy and irresponsibility. Therefore, Marxism is good news to sinners. Now, next point, which is essential. A crucial aspect of this Marxist good news is statism. And Marxism is not possible without statism. You say, what is statism? Well, it can be boiled down to this. The idea that there's no social problem for which increased political control isn't the best solution. Economic inequalities, politicians can solve that. Not enough young people going to college. State has a program for that. Medical and insurance costs too high. Politicians can craft a national health tax plan. Climate getting too warm. The legislature can cool it down. A global pandemic, obviously politicians can handle that. This statist ideology is so deeply embedded in most people's minds that their eyes are closed to any alternative. And this is no less true in modern Western democracies than it was in the Soviet Union and Red China. Now, statism is apostasy. You heard it here first, or maybe second or third. Statism is apostasy. It's a form of secular providence. When people lose confidence in a sovereign, gracious God, they seek for provision, they seek for protection, they seek for sustenance from politics. It's an apostasy that's been repeated many times in history, and it always ends in disaster, no exceptions. In the modern world, no society has been more statist than Marxism and what we have known as communism. Now, statism is necessary to the Marxist gospel because while rebels want to be lazy and irresponsible while living in material provision, they're also not content. They're greedy. They want more. They desire more than just subsistence living. There's nothing wrong with that last point, by the way. It's biblical. Nothing wrong with wanting more as long as you're not lusting for it and coveting. But in a Marxist society, that desire simply can't be allowed to be fulfilled. It can't be. Therefore, there must be a power strong enough to force people not to want to get more than other people. What is that power strong enough to force people? The state, of course. In the Marxist gospel, this is called the ownership of the means of production. This is why the state must own every single business and organization that provides material benefits, everything from grocery stores to gas stations to houses and housing. Now, as much as citizens may resent the state at times, they much prefer statism to economic liberty because the state will reinforce their laziness and their irresponsibility. They'd like more than just subsistence living, but they don't like additional possessions enough to go out and work hard to get them and keep them every day. Therefore, statism is part of the Marxist good news. Now, here's the main point I want to get to. What I've been describing is classical, what I'd like to term classical, Marxism. And Marx took his materialism a step further. All of our ideas, all of our religion, our philosophy, our economics, our arts are molded by our material condition, whether we know it or not. The rulers or elite in our Western society, they would say, they would accuse us, for example, we talk about freedom in order to justify our privileged position and to keep ourselves in power. That was Marx's accusation. Since there's no religion and nothing but the material world, there could be no greater human society than one of material equality. That's the issue. No heaven, no hell, no future. The only thing that's important is the material and therefore material equality. The just society is the materially egalitarian, that just means equal, society. Now, this is why, as we noted, Marx was a state socialist, and he increasingly came to believe that society would not change without armed conflict or revolution. That's just what happened in Russia in 1917, and in China in the late 40s, and in other communist regimes. But that is not the version of Marxism in the United States today. And if you haven't listened thus far, start listening right now. There might be a test later on, or at least a quiz. We're proud that we have been able to outlast the Soviet Union and Red China and poor, pitiful North Korea, which is the only classically Marxist society left in the world, basically. Unfortunately, the Marxism that poisons the Western world is today is even more dangerous than classical Marxism, and that is cultural Marxism. You say, well, Andrew, what is that? Well, I'm glad you asked. That's how I'm going to answer. Perhaps you've heard such strange new words or expressions as heteronormativity, intersectionality, cancel culture, systemic racism, wokeness, white privilege, omnisexuality, cisgenderism, toxic masculinity. These are all verbal products of cultural Marxism. Now, the cultural Marxists are Marxists, but they believe that classical Marxism, the older Marxism of the Soviet Union, was too narrow. Life isn't just about economics to the cultural Marxists. Oppression in society isn't just economic, but mainly cultural. The ruling classes impose their view of religion, sexuality, education, race, gender, art, science, and technology on the oppressed classes. This is oppression that must be overturned, not just economic oppression. I'll explain that in a minute. What was needed then was not merely material egalitarianism, but cultural egalitarianism. Now, like the classical Marxists, the cultural Marxists believe in revolution, but a revolution of a different kind. They doubted that the working class would rise up in violent revolution, as they had in Russia in 1917. The workers in the West are mostly satisfied with life and their jobs most of the time. So, to win in the West, you need a Marxism suited to the West. That's why it's sometimes called Western or revisionist Marxism, one that takes into account Western ways of thinking. Freedom, liberty, and equality, big ideas in the West, were ones they could capture to win the day. They would engage in, quote, the long march through the institutions, words attributed to one of the very first cultural Marxists, the Italian Antonio Gramsci. This describes the strategy of the cultural Marxists. They would reinvent the meaning of liberty, freedom, and equality to seduce Westerners and gradually capture their culture. Let me explain how that works to these cultural Marxists. To the cultural Marxists, I noted, humanity's main problem isn't economic. It's that society's ideas and institutions prevent us from fulfilling the good life. What's the good life, according to the cultural Marxists? It's being able to be exactly what we want to be, exactly as we want to live. Maximum autonomy. Autonomy. That means self-law. Theonomy means God's law. Autonomy means self-law. Every individual, according to autonomy, should be an artist, but in a very basic and profound sense. Every person should be able to paint his own life, his own meaning, his own reality. The world should be the canvas on which the person paints himself. Now, unfortunately, our society conspires to restrict our autonomy. Traditional institutions like the family and the church and business demand our allegiance, don't they? Husbands lead families. Parents direct children. Clergy disciple or discipline laity. Employers make demands of employees. This means they crimp our autonomy. This really means that these institutions crimp our autonomy. Now, I'm going to stop right there because I'm making an argument. How many of you are following me thus far? Okay. If any questions, I believe we'll have time for questions. Therefore, according to the cultural Marxists, we live artificial, unreal, and unhappy lives to conform to these cultural institutions and expectations because they don't give us our full autonomy. Therefore, we're alienated from our, this is a Marxist expression, true selves. You love that word, authentic, everybody says. So-and-so is authentic. Oh, the Marxists love that word, authenticity. The real authentic self is on the inside. And churches and families and businesses take that away from us. They prevent us from having that, from being our authentic selves. Yes. Marxists have always been concerned about liberating the true real self from the culture environment, suppressing it. Now, that might be solitary. We might be atheistic, exhibitionist, homosexual, transgendered. But whatever form it takes, that self meets resistance in traditional culture, especially in the West, Christian culture. To be truly free, Christian culture must be marginalized or crushed. All right, now I'm going to use an extended metaphor to help us understand this. Imagine thousands of tiny seeds full of flourishing, fruitful potential, but they can never fulfill that potential because they're submerged beneath hard, frozen, nearly impenetrable soil in places like Michigan, where Ron was from and Gary DeMar spent a lot of time. Frozen soil. Imagine further a sympathetic farmer who comes with a massive plow and cracks the soil and waters and fertilizes it so the seeds can finally sprout upward. Okay, the seeds in this metaphor are humans as we enter the world. But we're stifled, you see. We're stifled by the hard, frozen soil, which won't allow us to unleash the potential of our true selves inside us. That soil, of course, that hard soil is our society, especially the chief cultural institutions like the family and church and business. We should be free to sprout and grow upward and exhibit to the world all of our autonomous beauty. The exhibitionist self. What we need is a plow to break up this hard soil to get it out of the way. What is that plow in the metaphor? To break that up is the state. In our metaphor, that plow is the state. This is why cultural Marxists are statist. It's not because they simply love power. They want state power so they can destroy traditional authority, and especially Christianity. For cultural Marxists, what has been called liberty in the West is actually tyranny. How can this be, Andrew? Somebody is saying. Political liberty, hear this well. This is kind of a long sentence, but think through. Political liberty, what we have in the West, allows the freedom of families and churches and businesses to make demands of people. Therefore, to the cultural Marxist, liberation, what they see as the right kind of liberation, becomes liberty from the institutions that our free society grants the liberty to enslave us. Now, I know that sounds kind of convoluted, but that is precisely true. The state must pulverize every barrier to our true selves. In other words, we need statism to make us truly free. Following me there? Over time, this human liberation sees even nature itself as an oppressor. Like the Gnostics of old, creation is evil and a barrier to the good life. Male or female body parts are oppressive. Sex reassignment surgery must become gender affirmation surgery. Because I have a right to be the gender I want to be. A man becomes a woman who then becomes a dragon. You can find a picture. This is true. Have you seen the picture of this, the dragon man online? Just do a search. Google dragon man. You'll see it. It's not fake news. It's real. He's gradually cutting and discoloring his face and his body to become a dragon. He's self-identifying as a dragon. And why not? What right have you to say that he can't be a dragon? This is an extreme case, but not an inconsistent one. It's simply the latest example of liberation, and unless this grand social march is arrested, we should not expect the dragonization of man to be the most extreme example of cultural Marxism's liberation for the future. Somebody says, Andrew, that's really, really scary stuff. Yeah, sin is very scary. How do cultural Marxists instigate this liberation? How do they get the state involved in their great liberation crusade? Mainly by divvying up people into different classes and instigating conflict. They claim that all of the oppressed classes must fight for equality. This is called class consciousness. Ever hear about that class consciousness? Now, in Marx's day, the oppressors were the, have you heard this word before, the French word bourgeoisie? That is the elites, we would say at the time, the business owners. The oppressed were known as the proletariat. You've probably heard that before, good Marxist language. That is the employees, the proletariat, the wage slaves who demanded equality, you see. Now, it's important to understand equality. Let me take just a minute. By equality, the cultural Marxists don't mean equality of condition. That is, they don't mean everybody must play by the same rules. That, by the way, is the biblical idea. That is biblical law. Rather, they believe in equality of results. See the difference? The rules must be bent to make everybody get the same things. That's a very different kind of equality. Now, today's class consciousness is known as identity politics. And the battling classes are expanded. Men versus women, whites and Asians versus blacks and or Hispanics, children versus parents, millennials versus the middle-aged, heterosexuals versus homosexuals, wealthy versus poor and middle class, cosmopolitan versus nationalists, and other binary categories. Now, cultural Marxists portray one pole of this binary, like women, homosexuals, millennials, blacks, as oppressed, and demand that the state liberate them from all of their oppressors. Now, oppression here almost never means literal enslavement, abuse, or assault. Rather, it means disrespect, disapproval, or social inequality. If, for example, homosexuals aren't as respected as heterosexuals, they're oppressed, and they deserve state-coerced liberation. This is also where the new campus speech codes come from. The newly defined oppressed, millennials, are entitled not to be offended, you see. That's a new right. You have the right not to be offended, particularly by words from the oppressing class, older whites, teachers, men. It is this class conflict that produces cultural progress, according to the cultural Marxists. Marxists have always believed that life everywhere is filled with opposing forces. And the collision of these forces brings a higher, better reality. Ever heard of this expression, dialectical materialism? That's kind of the basis of that idea. Now, today's liberals like to be known as progressives. And the progress that they want, whenever you hear that, progressives, the progress they want is human liberation, that is, autonomy. That progress comes about only by conflict. So conflict is a good thing, according to the cultural Marxists. It's a good thing. And the elites should be fostering conflict everywhere. You ever notice it's that way on the news? All of the programs. Oppressed classes are mentioned. It's mentioned all the time. This person was mistreated. This race was mistreated. This women were, in general, were mistreated. The poor were mistreated. Always the conflict, producing conflict. Particular cases of someone who was treated badly. Fostering conflict all the time. That's cultural Marxism. Because progress comes about by that conflict. If you want a better society, you need to spread the conflict to get there. Unremitting conflict, violent if necessary. The objective of launching rallies and Twitter campaigns to challenge the hegemony, that's another one of their words, of men and parents and whites and straights and Asians and Wall Street is to create a conflict that ends in the liberation of the oppressed classes and a better world. When they finally did capture politics, the point was to change the entire culture, not just economics. One of the greatest cultural Marxists was the Hungarian, György Lukács. He summarized it best, and you guys remember this. Listen to this carefully. To the cultural Marxist, quote, politics is simply the means, the end is culture. Understand that for cultural Marxists. Capturing politics for that reason. The cultural Marxists are slowly capturing cultural institutions, schools and colleges, the media, popular music, Hollywood, Silicon Valley, even the churches to impose their vision. Their vision is cultural and only secondarily political. Now, this is a mistake that our libertarian friends often make. They think that today's Marxists want to capture the state simply to get raw power. If only it were as simple as that. The cultural Marxists are statists because they want to use the power of the state to create a new kind of society, a new kind of individual. They're not interested in state power just to bully everybody else. They want state power in order to create a new, secularized sexualized, self-centered individual. The individually autonomous society. That's what they want. Perhaps now we can grasp the full meaning of cultural Marxism. The cultural Marxists came from Germany, most of them, not all, to America in the 1930s, with money from major American foundations, by the way, John Dewey behind a lot of it. And they taught at places like at Columbia, Stanford, Brandeis. Their view then spread to younger elites all over the West. By the way, a striking example was Barack Obama, heavily influenced by these guys that came over in the 30s, their ideas, and their immediate followers who would have influenced Obama and others, particularly in the humanities departments of Western universities. And it's been wildly successful, wildly successful. We confront it every day. Let me just tick off here as we close some of the ways. First, think about feminism. Radical feminism began in the 60s. Of course, feminism had been around much earlier than that. And the idea that women should be treated fairly and equally according to the law has a long and honorable and biblical pedigree. But political and legal equality wasn't what the new feminists were after. What they were after was an entirely new view of what it means to be a woman and a man. They came to believe that sex is a social construction. Good luck with that. They even invented a new word usage for this. It's called gender. Now, that is a very old word, but its usage is new. You can have two sexes, but you can create 6 or 8 or 10 or 57 or 117 genders. I would recommend that you not use that word, except in a context like this. I mean, there are two sexes. It's not a dirty word. It's not a bad word. It's a legitimate word. Nothing wrong with it. Don't talk about genders. They hated the idea that maleness and femaleness are rooted in creation, the way God created things. The radicals wanted to say that the just society or the autonomous individual creates male and female or neither. Remember that? You get that little block sometimes. Male, female, now I saw unspecified. What does that mean, unspecified? I'm not a male, I'm not a female, I'm an unspecified. Okay. The fact that men and women are biologically different, according to the cultural Marxists, is incidental. This idea has wormed its way into our cultural consciousness. Today we have movies, men depicted in movies as caring domestic nurturers, and women as combat marines. It's routinely assumed that anything men can do, women can do, and vice versa. That's the leveling of all hierarchies. Ironically, this will mean the destruction of women. If biological difference is incidental, if gender is a human construction, womanhood is no safer than manhood. In the end, radical feminism abolishes the feminine. Second, think about homosexuality. I'm not sure if this is legal for me to say, but I'm going to say it anyway. As late as the early 70s, homosexuality was considered a mental disorder. Did you know that? And major psychological texts. I mean, I was around in the early 70s. Ron was an old man even then. But to say that today would be unthinkable and might literally, in some cases, end you up in jail, certainly with a large fine in Canada, where my friends in Canada are. The vision of the cultural Marxist to date has won. Homosexuality is considered no different than left-handedness. Today, so-called same-sex marriage is legal all over the West. Now, think about this. Let's set aside the morality of this practice for the moment. In other words, the immorality. Simply consider the fact that no civilization in the history of the world has permitted such a practice as homosexual marriage. Not even ancient Rome, where homosexuality was rife. Husbands would have little boys. Terrible, horrid thing. But no one could say they could marry them. The cultural Marxists didn't accomplish this only by bullying a resistant populace, although they did this by using the courts. In other cases, same-sex, quote, marriage was accomplished by its normativity on TV and in the movies very democratically. You ever notice that on the movies and TV? All the gay characters are clever and cool, and the more Christian characters are kind of dumb, they're kind of clucks, mean. This wasn't only an example of political tyranny, in other words, it was also an example of cultural tyranny, and of the two, cultural tyranny is the most dangerous. Cultural Marxists have increasingly convinced society that homosexuality is not an alternative lifestyle, but rather a fully legitimate lifestyle, one among many, no more valid than another. Third, think about law. The philosophy of law has been degenerating in the West since at least the late 19th century, but this process was radicalized by the cultural Marxists. The whole idea of the rule of law is that law is transcendent. It's impersonal. It's blind. It doesn't fluctuate from case to case. That is, by the way, the biblical idea of law. But this demands hierarchy, absolute right and wrong, or at least absolute legality and illegality. For the cultural Marxist, by contrast, the goal of the law is to produce favorable outcomes. Law should be used to fulfill a social agenda. Now, this is where sexual and economic and racial quotas come from. The older view is that law must always be sex blind and color blind and income blind. Neither rich people nor poor people, white people nor Hispanic nor black nor Asian, men or women, should be permitted to steal. Nor should the law give them preferential treatment in hiring practices, college admissions policies. This is equality before the law. That's the biblical truth. But cultural Marxists see this system as one privileging certain people. Therefore, they say that a legal system that creates equal outcomes is preferable to a legal system that treats people equally. The law has to be rigged to help the oppressed. Who gets to define the oppressed? Well, they do, of course. Finally, think about multiculturalism. How many of you here have heard of multiculturalism? All right. Multiculturalism is simply the global application of cultural Marxism. If we can overturn cultural hierarchies in a single society, if no single way of life or morality in a single society should be privileged, why then should any culture in the world be privileged over another? Who can say the West is superior in its civilization to Central Africa? Who can say 20th century Britain is superior to Native American culture? Who can say that Christian culture is superior to Islamic culture? What right have you to say that? In this way, things in the past that we valued about Western culture shaped by Christianity, thrift, hard work, chivalry, abstract reason, classical music, all become symbols of Western arrogance and, don't you love this, cultural imperialism. Why is a life of hard work and productivity to be preferred to a life of lounging and begging, like young able-bodied people in California on the streets? Why are academic specialties like logic and mathematics preferable to basket weaving and gender sensitivity? Isn't a primitive sub-Saharan dance just as valuable as Bach or Beethoven? Isn't a simple New Guinea free verse just as beautiful as Shakespeare? Why should our culture be privileged? By what standard can we label some culture superior and others inferior? This leveling of all hierarchies has been the wildly successful program of cultural Marxists. But the goal of multiculturalism is not to treat all cultures equally, though they say it is. It's to gut the dominance of Christian-influenced society and replace it with a secular, egalitarian culture. I'm going to conclude with this. I've kind of painted a drastic and bleak picture. And it's not drastic and bleak, certainly not for the future. That'll be in my next talk. Is the final success of the cultural Marxists inevitable? Can their view of culture be thwarted? Well, of course it can be, and it will be. With God, all things are possible. Just as God overthrew the ancient Roman Empire and the mighty Soviet Union, he can and will overthrew cultures at war with his truth. Second, cultural transformation can only be overturned by other cultural transformation. Nothing less will do. For instance, cultural Marxism won't be overturned by political victories. Please understand what I'm saying. It will not be overturned by political victories for the simple reason that it wasn't installed by political victories. It was installed by cultural victories. It was installed by changing the way people think and subsequently act about the individual, the family, the church, economics, technology, sex, music, law, education. Cultural Marxism will be overturned by something no less revolutionary, and that's biblical faith. That revolution, by the way, is much bigger than the church. And to assume that church transformation produces cultural transformation is the height of naivete. I have dear Christian friends who believe that, and I love them, but I believe they're wrong. If we can just get revival of the church, just have reformation of the church, everything will change. Wrong. Nice try, but play again. Since the culture is much wider than the church, so the revolution must be much wider than the church. You and I can and must be a part of that godly revolution. Every time a man and a woman take public vows to love and cherish one another, the husband taking the self-sacrificial lead and the wife following with persevering zeal, they're performing holy acts of cultural revolution. I want you to think about that for a minute. In modern autonomous society, there is probably no more culturally revolutionary act than a man and a woman getting married. Every time a young single Christian commits to sexual abstinence until marriage, resists the sexual commodification of our society, that young Christian works to overthrow our society of cultural Marxism. Every time a Christian attorney labors to protect families and churches from illegitimate government intrusion and hostility, he's acting as God's revolutionary. Every time a Christian businessman or a businesswoman refuses unethical choices, even when that choice dampens the bottom line, he or she is combating cultural Marxism. Every time a Christian mother teaches her children that God is real and that Jesus is the only way and that obeying the Bible is the only way of happiness, she is being a godly cultural subversive. Every time a church leadership stands for the Bible and against statism and against Black Lives Matter and against COVID political strangulation, it's overturning cultural Marxism little by little. Amen, Reverend Sandlin. That was good preaching. In conclusion, the gospel of cultural Marxism is the guiding elite vision and gospel of our time. It's not the final vision, however, and it's not the final gospel. The final gospel installs and advances the kingdom of God in Jesus Christ. That's our gospel and our kingdom, and we are its citizens, and we will win. Thank you very much.